bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel Sportsbook. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, Payne Insider. But before we get to Payne, this is the perfect time to remind you to go to FanDuel.com/bettheboard. Take advantage of all the generous sign-up bonus FanDuel is bringing to you just in time for football season, available to all new users on the sportsbook and casino side. Sign up, make your first deposit on FanDuel Sportsbook, receive a site credit if you lose within 72 hours. But we know here at Bet the Board, our players don't lose, so you'll have that to jumpstart things. Promotion only open to individuals who are at least 21 years of age and physically present in states where FanDuel operates. And Payne, you know, we're not even into the heart and soul of the football season, and a little birdie told me you might be a little bit under the weather, not quite operating at 100% capacity this morning.
Survive in advance. That's what this is about. So we are here, and we're talking AFC South. I'm just trying to figure out if the actual digging into the AFC South is what caused me to be a little bit under the weather.
I mean, it's probably known to induce more of a stomach flu, a visceral throwing up type reaction than anything else. I can say, now we knew we have three divisions left to go, that from top to bottom, this is the worst division in the National Football League. Of course, I'll probably have to eat crow and one of these teams finds a way to win 12 games. But at the same time, the Houston Texans, Jacksonville Jaguars, yikes. And we'll see what we get from the top of division in the Indianapolis Colts, and of course the Tennessee Titans. But because you're a little bit under the weather, we'll save that breath on useless banter, and we'll get right into the teams themselves. But before we do so, you want to offer up a friendly reminder for a contest that continues to grow by the day.
Over 1,000 entries already. Go to bettheboardcontest.com. It is our annual NFL Pick 5 contest against the spread. Every week there is a winner, as well as some season-long winners. $6,000 prize pool. So bettheboardcontest.com. Sign up. Make sure you follow all the rules so you're eligible for prizes. And I think at this pace, could have over 3,000 entries.
That is the goal. We want to have the biggest and best contest to date. And if you happen to miss any of those details that Payne shared, follow the Bet the Board Twitter feed. You'll see all the rules and regulations there. Payne and I continue to retweet it up until kickoff of opening weekend, so encourage you to do that. But let's kick things off, and this may be more of a two-minute drill as we go through the division in alphabetical order, starting with the Houston Texans, who find themselves listed at a robust 23-1 to win the division. Their win total at FanDuel Sportsbook sits at 4. You do have to lay $1.20 should you want to go under. It's amazing. When you look at the Houston Texans' overall profile, just a year and a half ago, this very franchise had a 24-7 lead over the Kansas City Chiefs in the playoffs. We were all talking about them maybe getting to the AFC Championship as a Cinderella. And here we are, a franchise completely in shambles, most likely without a franchise quarterback and really lacking direction. When you look at the Houston Texans, worst record against playoff teams last year, 0-10, and this is despite Deshaun Watson putting up gaudy numbers. But Payne, rather than break down what the Texans don't have on either the offense or defensive side of the ball, should we attack the coaching hire where David Culley takes over as the oldest first-time head coach after 27 years of serving as an NFL assistant?
I'm not really sure what's going on with the organization, and we're seeing the market react in a strong manner. I mean, this total has been blitzed from under 5, and this morning you look some places and it's 4 under minus 25. So like 3.85 is the win total here. So there isn't a lot of confidence in the Texans. And you know, you start to look at what this roster is, and it's tough to find wins on the schedule with who they're going to be trotting out there. I mean, we talked about Deshaun Watson and how fantastic he was. Over the last five decades, seven quarterbacks have had as good of a season as Deshaun had last year, and they finished with a losing record. Only seven quarterbacks in the history of this league have played as well as Deshaun Watson, and their team finished with a losing record. So, and Deshaun Watson's Texans last year, that was the worst record of any of those quarterbacks. So it really just shows how talent void this roster is. And somehow you mentioned the new regime bringing in an old coach in Culley, but the organization really doubled down on that approach. And they've managed the impossible, really, of having the oldest roster in the NFL with below average cap space. It's not a good combination. And so, you know, you start to look at the four wins last year and how they achieved it, and it was still an offense that was above average in efficiency, 13th. And now you have this massive downgrade at quarterback. And, I mean, Tyrod Taylor is what he is. He's 32. And the best attributes about him are his athleticism, his quickness, how fast he is. But at 32, those have all diminished, those things. And so this is just a monster downgrade. You do look at the schedule of defenses that the Texans will play. It's bottom six overall and against the pass. So there is some hope there, I guess. Defensively, that is going to still be a problem. You're looking at a unit that finished 30th in efficiency. The schedule of offenses this year are going to be really good. Going to be hovering around the top five rate and basically overall efficiency, passing offense, all of those key areas. So I don't really know how this team's going to get to their win total. And I think that's probably the interesting part about this. Like, what is the Texans' game plan for this season? And I think that's really the important part, trying to figure out if the market has priced the Texans properly. Because you look at where they opened, where it is now, nobody's projecting the Texans to only win 3.85 games. But we also know the Jaguars weren't a 1-15 team last year either. And so there's ways to tank without actually making it obvious. And it's when guys have nagging injuries that could absolutely play if games were important, start to sit out. And the guy under center that makes you most competitive gets benched. I mean, we saw Jacksonville last year. There's not a reason in the world Mike Glennon and Jake Luton are playing eight games
ever. How dare you talk poorly about
season for the same
how
team.
How dare you talk poorly about Jake Luton and the amount of money he made us as an Oregon State Beaver.
That is true. So that's the part that you really have to figure out is, you know, the roster construction really boggles my mind. It's just got so many vets on it. It makes me nervous that the Texans won't actually throw in the towel unless ownership demands it. You know, Cal McNair starts seeing like one of the college QBs look like the second coming. And then all of a sudden he's like, we need to tank and, you know, maybe get Davis Mills some reps here the last half of the season. But based upon the roster construction, I'm not getting that vibe. And so that would make me a little nervous to tail the steam and the professionals going under at a far worse number.
You know, it's so interesting because you look at the Texans, they had one draft pick in the top 100 and they use it on Davis Mills, which leads you to believe either they're going to throw his feet to the fire early on, or maybe they do think that this is their franchise quarterback and potentially if they drafted number one overall, because the Texans do things in, well, be nice and say unorthodox manner, that they would go after a guy like Kayvon Thibodeau if he was to be the first guy off the board to try and pick up a pass rusher. But you mentioned the defense, and this is a group that allowed more than 5 yards per carry, the worst by any team since 2012. They surrendered 30 touchdown passes en route to that 30th overall defensive efficiency metric and forced only 3 interceptions. Not exactly a recipe for success. And when you look at their aging backfield, Payne, I'm not quite sure that if we played in an over 40 league, you'd want Mark Ingram, Philip Lindsay, and David Johnson sharing the responsibilities toting the rock. So this is a team from a fantasy relevant standpoint that maybe it's Brandon Cooks and nobody else. But other than that, it definitely will be interesting to see how they're priced on a week in, week out basis. But from the cellar to a team, trying to figure out who exactly will be under center for week one. We have an idea of who it'll be going forward. But you look at the Indianapolis Colts, and they're a plus 140 underdog to win the AFC South. Now, it comes with the caveat that that number has drifted out with the injuries to Carson Wentz and Quentin Nelson. They were favorites or co-favorites, depending on where you shop, when those guys were expected to be in the fold. You look at their win total at FanDuel Sportsbook, and it's interesting because it's 8.5. You do have to lay a substantial price at $1.45 to go over. And when you look at this Colts team, 11 wins last season were the most by the franchise since 2014. They are seeking their first division title since 2014, but they were relatively fortunate as far as turnover differential was concerned, second in the league behind only the Titans. And when you look at their schedule composition, it starts off difficult, but seems to calm down a little bit where they may have a chance to make some hay. But Payne, that's the biggest question. Can Frank Reich get Carson Wentz to perform like the Carson Wentz we saw in 2017, or is this a reclamation project that was best left in Philadelphia?
It's a good question. I do want to start with a little bit of a story, which you know about, and it was probably July 22nd and 23rd. We were ready to fire a really large amount on this Colts under 10, and I wanted to do it before I left town on the 26th, and you and I talked a little bit about, you know, this potentially coming down the pike, and my guys kind of talked me off it timing wise, you know, wait till you get back, and we want to verify one more thing, yada yada yada. And I'm on vacation and I see the Schefter tweet hit my phone about Wentz and Nelson going down, and I think no less than 12 cuss words were spewed in public. I think people thought I had Tourette's. And so now you're looking at the market basically like 8.6 when you factor in the VIG. And the reports of Wentz and Nelson appear to be on the early side of the 5 to 12 week timeline. And so I'm almost getting intrigued by the over now. And I'm not sure that becomes anything. Maybe we're getting a little too cute, but I do lean that way now. And there were some positive reports about Wentz looking great before going down. But for me, any buy-in on the Colts is more predicated, and it has been with like Ballard and Reich. And the intel on Wentz was really good to hear, but I just am at a point where I need to see it to believe it. And we are getting to a point where we all know that Wentz's best season in 2017 came with Frank Reich by his side. So if you like the Colts, that's the sentiment you're going to hear, right? That he and Reich are on the same page spiritually, and they're friends on and off the field. And, you know, Frank's going to be able to fix his confidence and his mechanics. But I go back to 2017 and actually look at Carson's numbers, and there was a lot of noise, like a ridiculous amount of luck and fortune in some of those numbers. And Wentz excelled basically multiple deviations past the norm in both third down and red zone passing. 62% of Wentz's red zone passes graded successful, led the league by a long mile. If you remove the variance areas of red zone and third down, Wentz went from the second best quarterback in EPA per play to 23rd. And since 2017, Wentz is 27th in adjusted yards per attempt, factoring in opponent. Only Andy Dalton, your boy Maserati Mitch, and Sam Darnold are worse over that stretch. And so when you really go and look at Wentz, he's been average to bad every year of his career if you remove the red zone and third down metrics from 2017. So for me, this isn't just a flip of the switch where you start to rub elbows with Frank again and like all the problems are solved. And you start to look at some of the roster composition and you're down Anthony Costanzo. You lose your all world left tackle. That's not easy to replace. And I think we've talked over the years, Todd, and it's a really small sample size, but Anthony Costanzo's impact on the Colts is tough to ignore. He's missed 16 games over his career. Indianapolis has only won 25% of those. And in the games that Costanzo has played, they won 55% of those games. The team averages three less points in games that Costanzo hasn't played. And I know the hope is that Eric Fisher fills the void, but he tore his Achilles in the AFC Championship game. And he's danced around the question all offseason and said he's not putting a timeline on things. It would sound like a best-case scenario for Eric Fisher returning is the middle of the season. Now, there are some things to be excited about. Michael Pittman in year two. Paris Campbell, finally
That's
healthy.
That's our boy.
T.Y. Hilton, yeah. You know, you have T.Y. Hilton, who did show he had some juice left in the tank. And Zach Pascal's a pretty decent third or fourth option. And I know internally the Colts like this receiver group more than the outside world by far. And the other positive is the Colts offense is going to face a schedule of defenses projected to be bottom five overall against the pass and in pass rush. So there are some positives here, but you know, you're hearing all the reports about the offense just looking horrific. And really the only bright spot to the offense has been Jonathan Taylor. So even once you get Wentz back, he hasn't had this offseason to get acclimated with his new teammates. The rest of the players on this offense have been catching passes from guys that are backups. So even if Wentz is able to return week one, what does it look like at the early part of this season when the schedule is most difficult? So that's going to be interesting to navigate this team right off the bat.
It definitely challenges. I mean, you'd like to see some softer landing spots, knowing that Wentz didn't have that continuity with some of his skill position players and that offensive line. But, you know, as we've mentioned, things are going to start pretty hot and heavy right out of the gates. They'll subside a little bit, but how big a hole could the Colts potentially dig for themselves? And you mentioned Jonathan Taylor, just to kind of put in perspective what he was able to accomplish last season as he took on a bigger workload down the stretch. He joined some of the Colts' all-time greats in Edgerrin James and Marshall Faulk with 1,000-plus yards in a season and 10 touchdowns, led all rookies with scrimmage yards and touchdowns as well. So Taylor coming out of Wisconsin, there were high expectations, a lot of skepticism early on with a slow start, but really came on late when the Colts needed to lean on him, and you saw that attribute to an offense that found its stride under Philip Rivers' leadership over the latter portion of the schedule. Now, the one thing for the Colts, Payne, when you break down this roster, years ago we would have talked about this all offense, no defense. They've done a significant better job bolstering the talent group as far as the stop unit's concerned. Antoine Woods and Kwity Paye come in. Kwity Paye, of course, the first-round pick out of Michigan. You do lose some contributors in the likes of Anthony Walker, Justin Houston, Denico Autry, and Malik Hooker, but the reality of it is the Colts have two bona fide stars at different levels on this defense. DeForest Buckner up front and Darius Leonard, an all-world linebacker. Number two rush defense a season ago held opponents well under 4 yards per carry. Do you think what we've seen from the Colts defensively is sustainable going forward? And reason to believe that Matt Eberflus can continue to pull the right strings with this group?
Yeah, I mean, all of the reports from camp, as I said, is the Colts defense has just been dominant, and that's been even with some injuries up front. Like, Buckner hasn't played much during this camp, and so it's really an interesting unit. On the surface, though, it wouldn't shock me if we saw defensive regression. It really wouldn't. I know last year people thought the Colts defense was elite, and I just couldn't get around to believing that, honestly. Solid, no doubt, but not elite. And I think the only way this defense gets to elite is if Kwity Paye, who you mentioned, who had the number one highest pressure rate coming out in the draft, is the real deal. And guys like Lewis and Ture and Benigou take the next step. I think there's questions in the secondary. Indy is in search for their third corner, if you've done some reading, and it's basically between Carey and Rocky Sin. They're neck and neck for that role. But this is a secondary that finished 29th in explosive pass defense last year. I think there are other holes that a lot of people might not have recognized unless you really do some deep diving. And it was shocking because you see it unfold as you're watching these games, and then you go back and dig into the numbers afterwards, and you get that confirmation that your eyes aren't lying to you. But third down defense, not very good. And you mentioned having the highest paid linebacker in Darius Leonard. Somehow Indy was 27th defending running back passes. Very mediocre getting after the quarterback. 15th in pass rush win rate, 18th in actual pressure rate. And those numbers came against the sixth worst schedule of pass blocking O-lines. So Indy has to step up that part of their game if they are going to even be on par as last year. you have to replace your secondary coach, Jonathan Gannon, who was promoted to a defensive coordinator position. And a lot of people think that he is really one of the up-and-coming defensive minds. And I think we discussed this a little bit when we broke down the NFC East podcast, but Gannon has really taken a large role, or had a large role rather, in the week-to-week game plans that Indy was putting on the field defensively. And he was credited with the game plan that shut Mahomes and the Chiefs down at Arrowhead when they were shorthanded at quarterback. And then you look at the schedule, huge uptick. Colts are projected to face a top five schedule of offenses overall and a top five schedule of passing offenses. And last year, if you remember, we were kind of telling people like, hey, the defense is doing really well to start the season, but kind of just hold off and wait until, you know, they start facing some actual decent quarterbacks. I mean, they started the season last year facing Gardner Minshew, Sam Darnold, Foles. You had a rookie in Joe Burrow. You got Baker Mayfield before he was actually playing well and acclimated to Stefanski's system. The best quarterback that Indy faced the first 7 weeks last year was Kirk Cousins. And so this doesn't feel like a defense that is going to compete to be a top five unit, which most people believe that's the case. It feels more like a unit in that like 9-13 range for me.
When you look at this Indianapolis Colts schedule, I know we've both mentioned it. If somehow Indianapolis could be sitting 4-3 going into Halloween weekend with a 7-game start to the season that includes home dates against Seattle and the Rams, a trio of road games back-to-back-to-back that'll culminate in a Monday night football game at Baltimore. It's at Tennessee, at Miami, at Baltimore. You get a little bit of a breather against the Houston Texans in the middle. Then you travel across the country to take on the 49ers in Sunday night football, and that's where you have to make hay. So if you can go into that stretch 4-3, even 3-4, you'll get a trio of home dates against the Titans, Jets, and Jags. The other thing for the Colts, they don't get their bye week until week 14. So you better make sure that things are working in the right manner, because you're not going to have that off week to fix things early on if you can't get the offense headed in the right direction.
That's what's really interesting, because if you just kind of look at the schedule, the early portion of it, the first 8 weeks, it appears much more difficult than the actual rating. And I think once you remove the Texans from the equation, it really becomes one of the tougher schedules the first 2 months of the season. All of those teams in that area, right, that they're facing are 9-10 win teams based on the odds makers. It's just the Texans at like 3.85, which is really skewing where the Colts schedule lies the first 8 weeks of the season. It is a difficult schedule the first 2 months. And again, that's going to be really important to monitor, because Wentz just hasn't had an offseason in this new system with these new players around him, and it's going to be an adjustment period early on for sure.
Definitely a team to watch week to week and see what kind of improvements we'll get from Indianapolis as everybody can get on the same page. But from the Indianapolis Colts to an intriguing team in Northern Florida, that of course being the Jacksonville Jaguars, you look at their price to win the AFC South, FanDuel Sportsbook, listing them at 6-1. That number has come down from as high as 11-1 earlier this offseason. But you look at their win total, and I think this is extremely interesting. 6.5, you do have to lay $1.25 to go under, may speak to the volatility, the variance, or whatever other adjective you want to use in defining the AFC South, a division that may only take 9 wins to end up atop the heap. But when you look at the Jags, in comes a regime change led by Urban Meyer. When you look at Urban and what he's done, we'd be foolish to be detractors about what he accomplished at the college level. An overnight impact every step of the way. He was 187-32 in college, one of the best coaches in the modern era, but came under scrutiny at the tail end of his time, obviously in Gainesville, Florida, and of course at Ohio State, where the offense looked a heck of a lot more dynamic with Ryan Day calling the shots. When you look at the Jags franchise as a whole, one playoff appearance in 13 years, finished last season on a 15-game losing streak. You talked about it, though. A lot of that artificially manufactured to try and set them up to win the Trevor Lawrence sweepstakes. The only team to rank bottom three in both scoring offense and scoring defense last year. And you look at the overall upgrades in talent. A lot of exciting youth on the roster, but it may take a little while, Payne, for them to all come of age.
Yeah, I mean, it's a first-year quarterback. It's a first-time NFL coach. Lots of mixed coordinators and assistant coaches. This is going to take some time. And having watched the Browns-Jags Saturday night, the offense looked a little slow to me. And then, you know, I went and listened to Urban's postgame presser. He said, we didn't get plays in fast enough. Our players didn't process and snap quick enough. And then Trevor Lawrence indicated that this is a real large adjustment from college because he used to just look to the sideline to get the play, and now it's coming in through his helmet. And if you look, Jacksonville averaged like 27 seconds between plays against the Browns. That would have actually made them the 12th fastest offense last season. So I think it's really important to note that from a pace perspective, if Urban thinks above average tempo is snail-like and rants about it for 10 minutes. So, you know, a little piece of information there that, could have some impact weekly on, some of the Jags totals. Now, what is interesting is Lawrence didn't look overly comfortable. And I'm not really sure what's going on, because the best way to get him comfortable is just by throwing gobs of reps at him. And whether it's trying to enhance Gardner Minshew's trade value or whatever's going on there, Urban can't have his number one pick learning this brand new offense in a transition to the NFL, like splitting first team reps in camp. Like, you have to figure out, like, Trevor Lawrence has to be your guy, right? Like, you have to give him every snap he can get. And that's really not what's going on at camp, which is really bizarre to me. Darrell Bevell.
That's your boy.
Yes. And it's probably not going to be much of his offense. You know, it's about adapting to Urban's offensive vision, really. And we know what Urban Meyer's college offenses were. And you just wonder if something that basic can work when you don't have, you know, five-star kids going against three stars, and the opponents you're going to face each week in the NFL, their only focus is football. And basically, Urban just runs a power spread. He wants to run the ball. A lot of the passing concepts are horizontal and not vertical. And you hit this perfectly, because we've talked about Ryan Day since he's been at Ohio State leading the show. He's really opened up Ohio State's offense to a little bit more verticality. And I just think it's interesting. Now, maybe that changes, right, when you have Trevor Lawrence throwing and not guys like JT Barrett. So maybe we do see a little more vertical passing attack. But that needs to happen, because you can't just limit, you know, this game to, hey, we're just going to hand the ball off a bunch and try to overpower people and then just run a bunch of tempo and make short passes over the middle of the field. Like, it's just not a complex offense, and that's going to be really interesting to see if it works at this level. You talk about the offensive line that's in front of Trevor Lawrence. They have to be better. Somehow it's the most expensive offensive line in the NFL, and they were top 10 in health last season, yet they finished outside the top 25 in both pass block win rate and run block win rate. So, I mean, if you're going to allocate that much money to a position, they can't be horrific. And you have to give your rookie quarterback who's being thrown into the fire a chance. If you're looking at this team and the big guys up front can improve, then Jacksonville's offense has a chance to be respectable. There should be a little bit of a built-in advantage of not knowing what's coming, especially early on. And that does mesh pretty well with the schedule, because the first 6 weeks, Jacksonville plays the second easiest schedule in the NFL. And then they hit their bye week, and you can load more onto Trevor's plate and adjust and maybe counter to some of the defensive adjustments that you've seen from week 1 to 6. Both the schedule of run and pass defense Jacksonville faces this season project to be below average. So that's a positive. There's decent offensive pieces that I think Urban and Lawrence get to work with. James Robinson was a really pleasant surprise. You kind of pinpointed that one early. That saved your fantasy team last year.
My guy, the pride of Illinois State. Pick him up off that waiver wire.
Right before the season, too,
yep.
I think.
Had him pretty much from start to finish. He definitely paid dividends, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a guy who had over 1,400 scrimmage yards through 14 weeks, the most in NFL history for an undrafted rookie. And if he didn't sustain an injury and miss the final few weeks, he would have blown through the rushing record, too. Marvin Jones was a fantastic value add. 2 years, only $9 million guaranteed. He was top 20 in value above average receivers. DJ Chark had a breakout year in 2019, went over 1,000 yards with 8 touchdowns and a 2% drop rate on 114 targets. So I know he's working his way back from a broken finger. Urban Meyer claims he's going to be ready for week one. That will be interesting to monitor if you can get a bounce back from him. He's been pretty open in saying that he got frustrated last year with the team's success and it impacted him personally. And he claims he's in a better mental space now. And again, like, who can blame the guy? For 8 games, he had Mike Glennon and Jake Luton throwing him the ball. So,
again, more Jake Luton shots. Christ almighty. Show the guy some mercy here, Payne.
You also have Chenault, who had a really good rookie season, considering the circumstances. And maybe he plays a little bit more in the slot. Only played 28% of snaps there last year. But if you have Chark and Jones outside, Chenault will have to adjust. What's interesting, though, before I kind of end this, is that digging into some of the historical data, since 2000, there's been 13 college coaches making the transition to the NFL for the very first time. Urban Meyer's number 14. And of that group, only Nick Saban with the Finns, Jim Harbaugh with the 49ers, and Chip Kelly's Eagles have produced a better than average team by the metrics in year one. The other 9 coaches have fallen about 10.5% below an average football team in year one. So it's something to think about that, you know, running an elite college football program and trying to do the same thing at the NFL is really freaking difficult. It's virtually a different game altogether.
Yeah, and layer into that, you don't have a veteran quarterback either to lean on his experience in terms of getting the team in and out of the huddle and creating some of that locker room leadership. We know Trevor Lawrence will get there, but asking that of him in his first season might be a bit much, as Andrew Luck was actually the last rookie quarterback to post a winning record in his first season. The last Jaguars quarterback to go to the Pro Bowl, you ask, the pride of East Carolina, David Garrard, back before 2010. Now, defensively, Payne, when we look at the Jags, 31st in scoring and total defense. They gave up more than 400 yards in 10 of 16 games. I mean, they weren't able to get to the opposing quarterback, and they couldn't stop the run. That's not exactly a great combination of things to be able to do defensively. What I was surprised by looking at the roster, that Miles Jack is the only player that remains from that division-winning defense back in 2017. Now, there's a lot of young talent to get excited about, whether it's Chase Young out of LSU or Josh Allen need to be good edge rushers. This defense still seems to be at least a year, if not longer, away from moving into that top half of the league.
The bar is real low here, and you mentioned they finished 31st. And defensive efficiency overall. Urban made a good hire here. He brought in Joe Cullen to be his DC. He's been the Ravens D-line coach the last 5 seasons, so the pedigree is there. There's a couple nice front 7 pieces talent-wise, and you mentioned many of those guys, Josh Allen and Miles Jack and Chasen. I think the question is, can Cullen get those 3 guys' production levels to match the talent? And I think Josh Allen has the potential to be great. It's going to be a big year for him. Miles Jack has never been elite, though. And the guy largely responsible for having Jack last year with this massive turnaround in production was Joe Schobert. He basically allowed Jack to be more free-flowing and make plays sideline to sideline. And Jacksonville just traded him away to Pittsburgh this week. Chaseon is interesting. He's nothing but really raw talent at this point. He doesn't have a natural position. He was better in coverage and creating pressure, but was still below average in both. He was horrific holding up at the point of attack and tackling. He doesn't have a ton of bend, so he really, you know, didn't materialize into a natural pass rusher. Jacksonville, I think, is going to find out pretty quickly if he's part of the rebuild or not. But you do get Chasen removed. Like, this is now, 2 years removed from the ACL tear, so maybe that helps. The secondary was a bit of a mixed bag last year of really young guys or old players just hanging on. And not a good combination, especially when they were facing the third toughest schedule of offenses last year. Jacksonville finished 30th in defensive pass efficiency, 25th in explosive pass defense. It just wasn't good, you know? And I do think there is some level of hope in the new system that it being more aggressive might help across the board. But even with the improved talent and some of the scheme shifts, I'm not quite sure there's enough talent here. The schedule won't be as difficult this season of passing offenses, which is good. CJ Henderson, I must like him more than Jacksonville does because he's being shopped around already. The Saints have called multiple times about him. He was the 9th pick, only played 8 games last year. I can't figure out how they wouldn't value him, but I guess maybe it's a scheme thing. The Jags signed Shaquille Griffin and Rayshon Jenkins to bolster the secondary, and then with the 33rd pick, took Tyson Campbell out of Georgia. There has been some hinting from Joe Cullen that he is going to basically become Baltimore Jr. with how they operate defensively, and there's going to be a little bit of a transition to a 3-4 scheme. So the corner position, like I don't know why you would attempt to get rid of CJ Henderson, because your corners are going to be asked to hold up one-on-one. And I would expect a ton of blitzing. Baltimore is a defense that finished number one in blitz rate the last 3 seasons, so expect Jacksonville to look something like that. It was funny watching the preseason game. It was almost like, even though the Browns weren't playing their starters, Stefanski and that coaching staff were so sharp and smart that they actually game planned for a ton of pressure. So I know you were at the Raiders game, but you know, just a ton of screens early on to negate that pressure. It's like they knew what Joe Cullen wanted to do, and in a preseason week one game, they'd kind of schemed for it, which is really funny. So, you know, I expect Jacksonville's defense to look something like Baltimore's just in the scheme and what they want to do. Now, the talent isn't quite there. And maybe this helps Chase on improve. We know Dave Aranda at LSU used a 3-4 and allowed Chase to come off the edge standing up because he has been horrific with his hand in the dirt, but maybe that helps. But just based on scheme and some added talent here and the schedule easing up a touch and some positive regression for the Jags pressure rate, I think that means that they're going to improve here. I mean, you just look at some of the pressure rate stuff. They finished 11th in pass rush win rate, but it only translated to into 27th in pressure rate. So that's going to improve when you look at positive regression. So across the board here, I think, you know, we're not talking about an average defense, I don't think. But I also think they'll make a move from being one of the league's worst to maybe just bad this year.
Should be an interesting team to watch. We know a lot about the star power that's there. I think they're going to have a ton of eyes and expectations with Urban Meyer at the helm, along with the number one overall pick in Trevor Lawrence. It may not show up as early as week one, where the Jags will be in the unenviable role of having a first-year head coach and a first-year starting quarterback as a road favorite, even against the Texans. But we'll see how things manifest the deeper we get into the campaign. Perfect time to remind all of you, our loyal listeners, to go to fanduel.com/bettheboard. Sign up if you're a new user. Take advantage of the generous promos that are available to you. $1,000 free play right there at your disposal, just in time for football season. Also, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. All of the details about joining the Bet the Board football free roll right there and readily available for you. Make sure you're adhering to all of those. So should you win a week and you can take home the swag pack or finish atop the heap and take home the prestigious Bet the Board trophy. No greater accomplishment in all of handicapping this fall. You, of course, can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider, and I am Todd Furman. Follow me there as well. Payne, when we look at the Tennessee Titans, they are now the favorites to win the AFC South at minus -110. You look at their win total, it's 9 at FanDuel Sportsbook. Shaded to the over at minus $1.50. There are some 9.5s out there where you can go under. When you look at the Tennessee Titans resume from a season ago, they won 11 games and the division title for the first time since 2008. But this group only returns 12 of 22 starters, fewest of any team in the National Football League. They also had tremendous fortune in the turnover department, where they were plus 11. They were 7-2 in one score games. And when you look at this team, it was all about offense. Top 5 as far as offensive efficiency and ranks were concerned. Bottom 5 defense, and the same can be applied to their red zone metrics. In is Todd Downing for Arthur Smith, who departed to take over as head coach of the Atlanta Falcons. Shane Bowen takes over as defensive coordinator. We'll get to the Titans defense in a second. But when you look at this offense, Payne, we know the big headline acquisition was Julio Jones. For me, I look at a team that lost Corey Davis, lost Adam Humphries and Jonnu Smith, and say that Julio Jones and Jazz Reynolds may not be an upgrade when you consider that Julio has been far from truly elite over the last couple seasons. But all that being said, you can't argue how much different that Falcons offense looked when Julio was out there compared to when he missed extended periods of time.
You know, the Titans are one of the world's largest anomalies right now. And nobody knows what's going on or really how the hell it's happening. Okay? Because you hire a defensive coordinator as your head coach and the defenses are dreadful. And you bring in a quarterback that was really cast aside by a QB needy Miami organization. And you yourself made him a backup initially. And then you have this very upright running back that's slow to get started and doesn't really fit today's style as a lead back. And really, you know, was thought of minimally after the first two seasons in the league. And then he's run for almost 3,600 yards the last two seasons. It's really something out of the Twilight Zone for Tennessee. None of it makes sense, but here we are, you know. And you mentioned Todd Downing coming in. There were probably better candidates, but my understanding is he was promoted because Tennessee didn't want change. He knows the scheme. He knows the key players' tendencies. He knows what's worked the last 2 years and what hasn't. He knows the terminology, so none of that should change. You just hope the play calling is on par of Arthur Smith, because when Downing was calling plays in 2017 for the Raiders, he used the third lowest play action rate in the entire league. Ryan Tannehill has been mostly successful throwing with play action. The Titans used it on almost 37% of passes last season. That was a league high rate. And you just look at how much better Tannehill is with play action. I mean, yards per attempt, ADOT both increased more than 2.5 yards with play action. His passer rating was 110. So, you know, Downing can't really deter too far from what's made the Titans offense successful, and that's just a lot of play action. So hopefully he's cognizant of this, he understands it, and he changes his ways, even though that might not be the style of offense he wants to run. The other element here is Derrick Henry. And even if you're the biggest Titans fan, I mean, 2,200 scrimmage yards, you can only go in one direction, okay? And the fact that Henry's had 827 touches the last two seasons, including, you know, you had two playoff runs in there. I mean, just, I don't know if the body at this level can handle that kind of beating, you know? 396 of those touches were handoffs last season. And if you look at some of the historical data of running backs that have carried the ball at least 370 times and how they perform the very next season, it's not very good. And you can see injuries start to creep up. The amount of carries year over year on average has shrunk 43% due to injuries following the season of 370 carries. In terms of production, this is really scary because the number just sinks. If you look at defense-adjusted yards above replacement, the year running backs have 370-plus carries, and compare that the very next season, the running backs have only contributed about 9% of the yards above replacement the following year on average. So, I mean, it has just been this massive drop. Now, I'm not saying at 27 that that was going to happen or the drop is going to be that precipitous with Derrick Henry. And certainly, you know, the offense revolves around him and we see defenses going smaller to kind of play with the passing times of the league, and Derrick Henry really doesn't have a problem running over small linebackers, but you just wonder at some point if this catches up to him. Across the board offensively, I would expect some level of regression. You mentioned some of the luck metrics at the top, but Ryan Tannehill manufactured 6 game winning drives last season. That's not a normal rate. The schedule of defenses the Titans face go from well below average to top 10, both overall and against the pass. The run schedule is above average as well. And, you know, I kind of wanted to discuss some other things, but getting to your point specifically at the top with Julio Jones, I mean, I love him. Absolute freak. And even in the games that he played last year, he was a top 5 receiver. He was elite. But you have to gauge Julio Jones as a 32-year-old receiver replacing one of the most productive receivers last season. Corey Davis was 23% better than an average receiver. He was fifth in yards per route run. So how much can Julio Jones really be an upgrade over that production? And that's how you have to gauge it. Too many people are going to hear the name and assume upgrade because Julio Jones' namesake is better than Corey Davis, but you have to compare it to the production. And so for there not to be a drop-off, Julio's got to be top five. And that's a really high bar to clear here. So I'm kind of sharing the same sentiments as you when it comes to what Julio Jones is at 32. I think he's still fantastic. But for there not to be drop-off, I mean, he's got to be elite. And that's I think, a big question.
Yeah, I'm not sure you want to tell that to Titans fans who believe they're getting Julio Jones in the peak of his career. And while I know there's always noise in the numbers and some of the statistical production for Julio his last couple of years in Atlanta has declined, given the emergence of Calvin Ridley, it's still a receiver who went from 105 yards per game receiving in 2018 to 92.9 in 2019 and bottomed out last year at 85 and change. He also missed seven games a season ago. And the one bugaboo with Julio, whether it was the Atlanta offense, Matt Ryan, or Julio himself, he's never been a bona fide red zone threat. He disappears when you get down towards the goal line. Now, of course, having a running mate in AJ Brown, who, you know, I believe has that potential to really elevate his level of play to truly elite this season, you do wonder, and let's see what they get out of Anthony Firkser at the tight end. But to kind of put a bow on what you were talking about with Derrick Henry, for those folks who expect him to perform at levels that we've seen the last couple of years, you have to go no further than to dive into some of the prop markets that are available. And even with the addition of a 17th game, I mean, the over-under on Henry's rushing yards, depending on where you look, is in the mid-1400s. Of course, there's a caveat built in there that you have to account for injury and such. But if Derrick Henry only has, you know, 14 to 1500 rushing yards this year, where do the Titans go to pick up that rest of the productivity? I don't think Darrington Evans is that same kind of back. So all things to consider when you look at the Titans offense, knowing how well they performed in the red zone and such, and what will be expected of them, because Payne, it's a defense that's going to be completely remade. In comes Bud Dupree off of a torn ACL from Pittsburgh to help bolster a pass rush that was non-existent. They spend some money in the secondary with Janoris Jenkins. They draft Caleb Farley. You bring in Danico Autry, Elijah Molden, and Amani Hooker. Apparently Hooker is the guy that's really getting rave reviews so far in camp. You lose Jadeveon Clowney, Malcolm Butler, Adoree Jackson, who I think you and I played as many games as members of the Titans as Adoree did in that secondary, along with Kenny Vaccaro. But again, you mentioned it. You were the first one to bring it to my attention, you know, years ago. When a team doesn't do what a head coach is brought in to kind of put his fingerprints on, it's an immediate cause for concern. And the Titans last year defensively, I don't know if there's enough time to go into all the metrics where they were in the bottom of the barrel as far as how that unit performed.
Well, they keep making the playoffs, and the offense has been elite, so Vrabel's been getting a pass. But I think we've made our feelings known, and I would even go as far as saying we started the movement on Vrabel's defense as being extremely underwhelming. And with Vrabel in Tennessee, he's never had a defense finish above average in efficiency. 18th, 18th, and 29th. So if it's not for hitting the lotto with Tannehill and Arthur Smith and Henry, basically simultaneously, like Vrabel's probably a coordinator somewhere. Now, the defense has a chance to improve and give Vrabel credit. He's at least willing to acknowledge the downfall because you bring in a new defensive coordinator and there's probably going to be five new starters. And there was a lot of change this offseason. There are some nice pieces. It's just a matter of health. Bud Dupree, we outlined his effectiveness on the AFC North podcast, but I mean, this is a guy who had the fastest get off time of any defender. And in games where he did not play, his running mate TJ Watt's pressure rate dropped to 10%. So Dupree was fantastic last year, top five in disruption rate. If he can mimic that type of season again, it's going to go a long way to improve the Titans defense. But he's 8 months removed from ACL surgery. He's still not a full participant at practice yet, so you got to monitor that. And if you've heard Bud's comments in the press, it's basically like he is ready to go, but the team's holding him back. Now, that's a positive sign that he's ready to roll and he's not wearing a knee brace, but we'll see if he can be as effective. And then you do get Jayon Brown back, which is huge. He's going to be healthy now in the middle of your defense. He was solid in pass defense, top 25 in yards allowed per coverage snap at the linebacker position. Danico Autry, I think, is a solid piece. Nothing elite, but a plus defender, and I think moving him inside only helps. He's not a true end, which is where the Colts played him a lot last year, but if you can slide him right into Jeff, you know, right next to Jeffrey Simmons, I think that will help him. And then they threw a bunch of bodies at the cornerback problem. And that's still the question mark, because I don't know what Janoris Jenkins is at 32. He's probably still a plus defender, but there were times last year where he would get beat. Caleb Farley is the first rounder from Va Tech. He's dealt with a bunch of back injuries. He's still working his way back, but if he's healthy, he has a chance to be solid. And, you know, there's still some question marks, I think, and there's going to be a reliance on guys that are either coming off injury, haven't proven themselves, or are getting up there in age. But it's impossible not to improve. And I think the ultimate question becomes is if the defense improves by 15 or 20%, but the offense regresses by 15 or 20%, and we know offense is far more valuable overall, the Titans are still going to regress as a team. The problem is, Todd, when you attempt to potentially fade the Titans, like, what makes you nervous in division? And that's really the issue on, like, why we haven't attempted to fade them yet and go under the 9.5, because, you know, Jacksonville, even though they took some money from pros over 6, and that's why they're at 6.5, we're starting to, like, you get a first glimpse of that offense, and I know it's the first preseason game, but it didn't really leave you warm and fuzzy. And then you've had the Colts injury issues, and, you know, we were initially going to fade them. And then you have Houston. So it's really tough to attempt to make a case, even though the Titans are going to regress. It's just a difficult way of figuring out how to fade them. But I think probably week to week might be the best way to go about that.
Hey, I mean, that's the great part about the betting market is you can have strong sentiments about a team's overall outlook for a season and bet their win total over under. You can try and attack the divisional markets. But if you feel there's going to be some variance and volatility, that's the great luxury we have as bettors that bookmakers don't, where you're going to get ample opportunity to bet on or against some of these teams. And the Titans have all that potential to fit that bill. I'm definitely curious, Payne, because there's two fan bases that I'm intimately connected to on a variety of levels, having done a ton of media work. And in Chicago, I've been a detractor so far of Justin Fields, just kind of tempering those expectations. And people want to run me out of town there. And yesterday in Nashville, I talked about the Titans defense and how, yes, fresh faces are good, but expecting them to look like the 85 Bears, probably not realistic in any stretch of the imagination. And heaven forbid you say that this Titans offense could take a step back. They'll run you out of town with pitchforks and fires at the end of those sticks. So an interesting division for all the wrong reasons, in my opinion. Clearly someone's going to have to win it, and we'll figure out exactly what these teams are on a week-in, week-out basis. Follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod on Twitter. Follow Payne on Twitter as well, at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. Sign up for the Bet the Board football free roll. All the details right there on our Twitter feed. Go to FanDuelSportsbook.com. Take advantage of the generous sign-up offers that are there. Make sure you use a code Bet the Board. And Payne, I don't want to keep you too long. You've been a soldier so far, getting through four teams in the worst division in football while performing at maybe 60% of capacity as far as your voice is concerned. But there is one final order of business to transact, and our listeners know we didn't say there was going to be a best bet or a win total or anything else to sink their teeth into on every show during the preseason run-up this year. But is there an opportunity, whether it's a season-long outlook or maybe even a week two preseason game, you feel is worth a small investment?
Well, no one knows this, but you are the real MVP of this podcast, because we have new microphones this season, and for whatever reason, I wasn't sure that there was a mute button on here, but that has come in handy as I swallow some cough drops and drink some hot tea throughout this process. It's basically been on mute every time I'm not speaking. Let's go with what we discussed last night, and if you want to deliver it to save my voice, that would be much appreciated.
Sure. It'll be a preseason game, bet number 422. That would be the Minnesota Vikings as modest favorites. I know we talked about it. We'll get into the best way to try and attack in a second. Taking on the Indianapolis Colts, when you look at Minnesota, this was a team that was flat out embarrassed last week against the Denver Broncos, obviously to our benefit, with Denver our preseason best bet. But you look at Coach Zimmer and his track record. He's always placed emphasis on kind of building that winning culture, and he was not shy about calling out a variety of players, whether it was going into the half or in the wake of Kellen Mond's performance. Now, Kellen Mond had about two practices under his belt. We didn't think he was going to get a lot of reps. Lo and behold, he was out there and looked like he was rather winded with a quarterback who's going to use his legs as his most dynamic weapon. Don't expect Dalvin Cook or Justin Jefferson to be out there. If Jefferson plays, it's an added bonus. But all speculation is that Kirk Cousins is going to be out there for at least a handful of series amid all of that controversy, that it could be big for his confidence building going forward. And defensively, hey, look, this is a Vikings team that's going to be better this year. They didn't play anybody last week. Anything would be a significant upgrade. But Payne, more importantly, the Colts are going to go with your boy, Sam Ehlinger, in the first half. Let's build a nice 3-touchdown lead before Jacob Eason tries his best to bring the Colts back from the abyss.
I didn't dare mention this when we gave out the Broncos as a best bet, but even after the loss last week, Zimmer is 20-6 in the preseason. So he really puts an onus on this. And as you alluded to, some of the quotes have been quite telling, and practice has been really intense this week. So let's go with the Vikings. At this point, though, I do like the money line option, because in the preseason, one is a very key number. So I think it's worth going the money line route here and lay the 25 cents.
So when you look at Minnesota, this is a team that obviously we talked about at great lengths when we previewed the NFC North. We broke them down earlier. It's a team we have high expectations for, and it's all about trying to build the winning culture. Hopefully it starts Saturday afternoon when they welcome in Indianapolis. All right, Payne, time for you to go rest your voice. You have any parting shots? You want to take any cheap shots in my direction or anything else to get off your chest before we get a 72-hour break from one another?
No, that's it, man.
Minnesota Vikings, your Bet the Board podcast best bet for this, your AFC South preview. Best of luck with all of your wagers this weekend. We'll be right back here with you Monday, previewing yet another division on our march to the start of the regular season.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.